Welcome to the Charleston School of Law podcast. My name is Jessica Hernandez. I'm a 2L student here at the Charleston School of Law, and it's my privilege and honor to be your host for today's show, featuring a question and answer session with Colorado Supreme Court Justice Richard Gabriel. Justice Gabriel was appointed to the Colorado Supreme Court in 2015. In 2017, he was retained to the court by a majority vote of Colorado citizens. Prior to serving on the Colorado Supreme Court, Justice Gabriel served on the Colorado Court of Appeals, and before that, he worked as an attorney in trial and appellate litigation. Now let's join our question and answer session with Colorado Supreme Court Justice Richard Gabriel. Justice Gabriel, what are some best practices for oral arguments that you've learned, observed, or experienced over the years? Are there any do's or don'ts that you want attorneys who argue before a court to keep in mind?
Preparation is really important, and it's remarkable how frequently lawyers are not well prepared on some basic things. We expect you to know the law, not only your cases, but the key cases from the other side. We're not going to do gotcha questions. We're not going to ask about the 15th case and a 16th case string cite. We're going to ask about the high level. We do expect appellate lawyers to know the record. Knowing what you want, the Chief Justice here, his favorite question in oral arguments, what is the rule you're asking us to adopt? You'd be surprised how often the lawyers are not able to answer that question. You should know what you want us to write as the holding. So thinking about that are really, really important. Being yourself is important. Credibility matters. Don't be someone you're not. You want to be formal, want to be respectful. A big don't is don't tell jokes. Don't try a joke in oral argument. They tend to fall flat. When the judge makes a joke, you can laugh, but don't try your own. I'm from Brooklyn, New York originally. I could talk very fast, but talking, slow down and keep your voice up. If we can't hear you, it's not that helpful. So pretty important. Do use your limited time wisely. So an important one is get to the point. Start with your best argument first. I am a big fan of introductions and roadmaps in oral argument. So start with, may it please the court, my name is so-and-so. This case involves whatever. We submit that the court below erred for three reasons. That's a lovely roadmap, and it serves several purposes. One, it lets the advocate calm down. I mean, you're going to be nervous unless you're not human. And so it gives you a chance to breathe and calm down. It also, as important, it gets your headlines out. It may well be you're not going to get to all of the points you want to make, and the court is going to let you do that. I argued a death penalty case some years ago where we raised a lot of issues. And I'm not, an appellate argument usually raise your one or two best issues. On a death penalty case, that's different. And so I raised 10 issues, I think it was, and we were going to argue five of them. And I started the way I just described. And I said, with the court's permission, I'm happy to answer any questions, but we've raised 10 issues in our brief. We'd like to address five of them today. Although, of course, I'll address anything the court wants. We submit the court below erred for five reasons. I got to the third reason and I got interrupted with a question. You stop and you answer the question. And then the presiding judge said, Mr. Gabriel, you said there were five reasons. I got the first three. What were the other two? He was poised to take notes. So you're going to get your headlines out. So that kind of roadmap is useful. Get to the point. Answer questions. Welcome the questions from the court. A good oral argument looks like a discussion among learned colleagues. I see lawyers all the time. You get the eye roll when you ask a question. The judge's questions are your window into what the judge is thinking and where you need to be persuaded. So welcome them and go with it. Be flexible. Don't get wedded to your outline. You may have thought you were going to talk about issue one, and all the court is talking about is issue two. Pay attention to that. You're a fool, or it's foolish if you don't go where the court wants to go. They're signaling that to you. So take that. Answer the question directly. Don't hem and haw. It's very obvious when a lawyer is evading an answer, so don't do that. Concede when you have to. Think about what you could concede in advance. And there are some things you cannot concede and some things you should concede. Don't get buried in the outline. Avoid histrionics. We're not a jury. We're not looking for the big emotional appeal. We're going to talk to you about the law, so focus on that. Never engage in a personal attack. Even if you get attacked, you take the high road. I'm fond of saying show me, don't label it. So if your opponent accuses you of misstating the record, you can get up and respond. They brazenly accuse me of misstating the record. They're continuing their practice of misleading this court themselves. Or you can say, they've asserted that we've misstated the record to you, particularly with respect to witness X. The witness's testimony was as follows, quote, that's a powerful way to respond to it. No histrionics, it speaks for itself. So go that. And last thing I'll say on kind of this general question, on a point about rebuttal, sometimes the very best rebuttal is when the court looks at you and says, do you have any rebuttal? And you've got 3 minutes left. And you stand up and say, unless the court has any further questions, we'll stand on our opening argument. That's a powerful, you just basically told the court the other side didn't lay a glove on you. That's a powerful place to be. If you're going to make a rebuttal argument, my view of the world is you want questions on your opening argument. You don't on your rebuttal, I think. You want to make a couple of bullet points. I frequently see lawyers get up and say, I just want to make three quick points on rebuttal. And I pick up my pen and I'm ready to write them. And they never get past point one because they talk about point one for the 2 minutes they have. Bullet points on rebuttal, I think, are really, really important. Those are just, I'm covering a lot really quickly, I know. But styles, tactics, and strategies, remember you're talking to us about the law. Take the high road, get focused on the law, and go right to it. Don't spend a lot of time, if you had a 15-minute oral argument, in a court of appeals, say, telling us the facts. You're wasting your time. Get to the point and really do listen hard to where the court is coming from. I think that's really, really important. The strategies that tactics that don't work are the lawyers who try, the emotional appeal. It's very obvious when you're trying an emotional appeal. The facts need to speak for themselves. So best arguments are the ones that just feels like a conversation, and that's what you want to aspire to. Do answer the question, though. Please answer the question. And one pet peeve of mine, and then I'll stop. We will frequently ask a hypothetical question on our court. And I bet 80% of the time when we pose a hypothetical, the lawyer response is, that's not my case. I know it's not your case. That's why it's a hypothetical. And that's kind of silliness. The reason we're asking it is we're trying to figure out where to draw a line. What are the ramifications of the rule that you're asking us to adopt? And we're trying to figure out its limits. That's why we ask. And so answer the question and don't tell us it's not your case. That's why we asked for a reason.
Every attorney must cultivate their own style and figure out what works best for them. Do you have any advice for law students trying to discover what does or does not work for them?
Like I started with a roadmap and then turning to issue one and start kind of in the small steps and let your own style develop as it goes. And you need to pay attention. We all have our quirks. People have nervous habits. There are people, I wear glasses, the glasses are off, the glasses are on, they're off and on, off and on, and it's distracting. Or particularly lawyers who will gesture a lot with their hands. I'm not saying you hold on to the podium white-knuckling it, but you want to be careful about gestures that might be distracting to the court. How do you cultivate your own style? The more you do, the more your style comes out and you get comfortable. So I would start with kind of textbook approaches and let your style develop on its own. Relating to that, there are some people who go to oral argument with no notes. Some people can make that work and some people can't. I never went with no notes. I felt more comfortable having notes and I never looked at them. It was a crutch. And if that's not comfortable for you, don't try it. The more you do, the more comfortable you get with your style.
Whatever your style or authentic version of yourself may be, you still need to be the most professional and polished version of yourself, correct?
Absolutely. Always want to be highly professional, respectful. Probably don't want to say you guys to the court. Although there's a woman is arguing, maybe even today, her 50th Supreme Court argument, one of the most accomplished advocates in the U.S. Supreme Court, and she actually does that. She'll say, you guys, you don't want to do that. Be very, very respectful. When the judge starts talking, you stop talking. Oh, another pet peeve of mine. When the judge asks a question, please don't say, I'll come to that in a minute. answer then. The judge is asking then for, unless three justices have asked you a question and you got to answer all three. Let me take Justice Gabriel's question first and I'll come to yours, Justice Moore, something like that. But be very respectful regardless, always.
Can you tell us about a time when you were presenting an argument and it went differently than you thought it would? How did you adapt in the moment?
Yeah, that happens all the time. And when I was probably less experienced, they'd ask a question, I'd get really, really nervous and try to find the exact citation of something. And I kind of learned to not do that. But where this comes up more than anything else is when you thought you were really focused on a particular issue and the court is focused elsewhere. And that's okay. And sometimes you'll get a question where the court, a judge or justice will ask a question out of left field, maybe even something you didn't brief. That did not happen to me, but I've seen it happen. I've seen my court do it. You know, how do you deal with it? The worst thing you can do is, if you don't know the answer, is fake it. If you really are not, you just truly don't know. And frankly, even if that was a matter of you probably should have known it, I think you just got to take it and say, I'm afraid I don't know the answer, Your Honor. I apologize to the court. I'd be willing to certainly offer to submit a supplemental pleading in the next day or two to answer the question, but I'm afraid I don't know. Would be the best way. That, again, that my biggest fear in oral argument as an advocate was the question I couldn't answer. I didn't have that happen, but I certainly would have questions I hadn't thought of in preparation that came from a different direction. You be flexible. You know, and the more experience you have, the easier it is to think on your feet. The more preparation you do, the easier it is to think on your feet. If you get a question that comes out of left field and you don't understand it, it is perfectly appropriate to say, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question. Can you try it again? Or, Your Honor, I think what you're asking me is X. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. That's perfectly appropriate. Those are the biggest issues I had. You know, the questions that are, didn't expect the argument to go the way I thought it was going to go. I thought we're going to focus on one issue and not the other. But that was easy enough to adapt as long as I was flexible enough to, oh, I guess we're going to focus on issue two today, not issue one. You don't want to stubbornly resist going where the court wants to go.
I imagine that it's more common than not for a young attorney, especially in their early in their career, at their first job even, it's common for a young attorney to make a mistake. How should an attorney handle making a mistake, whether in oral argument or in their daily work?
And the answer is own it. And so if you've made a mistake during your oral argument and you're on your first, your opening oral argument, or you're the appellee and arguing, and you realize you've made a mistake, perfectly appropriate to say, Your Honor, it occurs to me, I think I misspoke a minute ago, and correct it right then. If you're done, if you get rebuttal and you realize, or you're with co-counsel and your co-counsel says you said something wrong in your opening argument, it is appropriate to get up and rebuttal and say, I believe that I misstated something in my opening. I want to correct it. If your time is up, it is appropriate to send a letter to the court the next day, copying your opponent. I realized after the argument that something that I said was incorrect and I want to correct the record. Now, don't ever abuse that privilege. I'm not talking about now submitting something that you wanted to say, but you forgot. That's not appropriate. But something where you have made a mistake, you miscited a case, you miscited the record, I think we have an obligation to correct that. And I think it's appropriate to just own it directly that way. And I've seen lawyers write letters to the court the next day, copy the other side, just saying, I misspoke an oral argument. So owning it is the best way to go on something like that.
You mentioned being able to the importance of being able to rely on your co-counsel and your co-counsel being able to help you if you've made a mistake. In moot court, it's very important to collaborate and it's very important to have good teamwork. And sometimes that could even factor into our scores for moot court competitions. Is collaboration important for oral advocacy in real practice in everyday work as an attorney? How does teamwork play into oral advocacy in front of a court?
That's a great question. And it comes up in a couple ways. Sometimes you'll have co-counsel sitting with you at counsel table. And they might write a note to you. In an oral argument in an appellate court, what you don't want is your co-counsel sitting at table to be passing you post-it notes every 30 seconds while you're arguing. That will be distracting to the court. But when you're sitting down, and they write a note, you're going to have rebuttal time or something like that is perfectly appropriate. And again, sometimes if the lawyer really misstated something, it would be appropriate for your colleague to pass a note to you that said, point that out to you then. So that's one place it comes up. Another place it comes up where you're dividing time with a partner. This frequently does not work in the real world. Everybody will say, I'm going to go for 15 minutes. My colleagues can go 15 minutes. Or maybe it's co-defendant or co-plaintiff. And one lawyer is inevitably going to take up most of the time. So what we've started to do on my court is we will ask how much time, and we'll say one side says, I'm going to take 20, the other side's going to take 10 minutes. We'll set the timer for 20 to try to keep that on track so that doesn't happen. But it's just very hard. In many courts, they don't do that. And inevitably, the first lawyer is going to take up all the time. And that can be very frustrating to the second lawyer. So really working that out carefully and scripting it out carefully to make sure that you don't step on each other. Probably the best way to do that is to really have a clear dividing line between issues. One lawyer is going to argue one issue, the other lawyer is going to argue a different issue, and there's not overlap. So it's clear who's arguing what, so that you don't step on each other. So I think that's an appropriate place to collaborate and can work. And then a kind of a different kind of place this comes into play is we sometimes have seen lawyers from the same office, like the attorney general or the public defender, argue right after each other on the same issue. It surprises me sometimes how frequently they haven't coordinated well. We had one argument and the lawyer handled it quite well and made a joke that worked well, which is rare. But first lawyer argued, and then this lawyer's arguing a second case, and he had seemed to be taking a different position than what his colleague had just argued right before, that they were not consistent. And one of us asked, I'll make up names here. So are you disagreeing with Mr. Jones, who just argued? And the lawyer at the podium said, without missing a beat, is he still sitting back there? And everybody laughed. It was a good moment. But that was, that was something I would have thought they would have coordinated a little bit better to not have inconsistent positions. So that's enough. If you're in the same office arguing a similar issue right after each other, you want, as a team, want to make sure that you're all on the same page.
Could you speak briefly to the importance of ethics, professionalism, and civility for young attorneys and any advice you might have in that regard?
It is critically important. It's what I talked about taking the high road. What we have as lawyers more than anything else is our credibility. And when you lose that, you've lost everything. Sometimes you're in a case and your opponent has been very, very difficult. And to you, you've been living with this difficult lawyer on the other side. We don't know who's wearing a white hat and who's wearing a black hat. And so if the lawyers come up and they're both sniping at each other because they've had a rough relationship, it doesn't help the client any. It's not persuasive to the court. To us, it sounds like kids in a sandbox having a fight. Or it sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher, It's not impressive. We expect professionalism. We expect civility. You take the high road. And it relates to what I said before. They're being uncivil to you. They're accusing you of everything under the sun. You can respond in kind, or you can respond by showing the court why there's no merit to what they're arguing. Courts figure out pretty quickly where the credibility lies in a courtroom. You want to be the person, particularly in a trial courtroom, this doesn't happen in appeals, where the court's going to look to you for the answer. That I take some pride in the fact that happened to me with frequency in a courtroom, that they knew I would be prepared. And so the court may be hear an issue and then say, Mr. Gabriel, what do you think? That's the one you want. That's the person you want to be. There's no substitute for taking the high road, for being professional, for being civil. Many lawyers, particularly in this now very competitive world, in this world where we have so much polarization, they think that the chest pounding is the most is impressive and most persuasive. That's not the real world. The paradigm of the great lawyer used to be Atticus Finch. In To Kill a Mockingbird, right? This model of dignity. Now what so many people see, and particularly clients see, is, what's the paradigm? It's Tom Cruise and A Few Good Men. What do you want? I want the truth. You can't handle the truth. You know, and that's, and unfortunately, many of our clients think that's what lawyers do. And they want you to chest pound and be that. And that this is not easy, but we have an obligation to control our clients. We have an obligation to educate our clients about, you know, the difference between what you see on TV and what you see in a courtroom and why that's not impressive. It's emotional for them. It's personal to them. So somebody's going to ask you for a reasonable extension of time. The client's going to say, oppose that. And you need to kind of school them. Well, no, they're going to get that extension. And we look foolish by opposing that. Just, you know, or they want to seek attorney fees on everything when there's no basis for it. You lose credibility. Just a practical tip. One thing that I did in practice, whenever I had a new client, I would meet with them. And I would meet with them in person, not on Zoom. We didn't have Zoom back then. Not on the phone. Have a meeting. And I would talk about how the case is going to go and their relationship and my role and their role. And I would explain, as your lawyer, my job is to provide objective, sound legal advice to you. I get that this is emotional for you. This is personal to you. It can't be personal to me, or I'm not going to do my job. And I would tell them at the first meeting, we're going to have disagreements as this case goes along. You're going to want me to do something that I'm going to tell you. I'm going to remind you. Remember that first conversation we had? We're going to have a disagreement. We're here now. Let me tell you why what you're suggesting is not a good idea. And I had success with that because I established those parameters for the relationship early on. That's a good place to be. And it happens on appeal, where you'll find in an appeal, particularly if you go in the criminal defense world, your client's going to want you to raise issues that you know have no merit. And the risk you have when you raise 9 issues, you might bury a good issue in a bunch of not good issues. And that's not helpful to you. If you got a death penalty case, then you got to throw in the kitchen sink because you run the risk of having a federal court down the road saying you waive something. But in general, good appellate lawyers know you want to raise your best 1 or 2 issues. And that's the best way to go. I got a little bit off track, but civility, professionalism are important because your credibility is important. And the lawyers who are the most professional, what I was starting to say was many clients think that the more professional a brief is, the less effective it is. I disagree with that. The more professional a brief is, the more effective it is. The statement of facts in a brief, if you take out all the adjectives and adverbs and you just tell me what happened and the equities move, I get to the end of the facts and there's no embellishment. Here's what happened. And my heartstrings got tugged. My reaction is that doesn't seem fair. Now you're a step ahead. If you put in a bunch of adjectives and adverbs and are pounding the table, you're probably losing. I used to, on occasion in a trial, I would use this little trick. My opponent got up and it was a bunch of histrionics and yelling and screaming. And then I would get up and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there's an old lawyer adage, and it goes something like this. When you have the facts on your side, you pound the facts. When you have the law on your side, you pound the law. When you have neither on your side, you pound the table. We just heard, with all due respect, my friend pounded the table at you for about 20 minutes. Let's look at the law and the facts. That level of professionalism, high road, law and the facts, are a model for what success, in my view.
In my own experience with moot court, I still get nervous every time, although not quite as bad as the first time I ever made my oral argument for Elraw. Do nerves or nervousness fade over time? Do you ever still get nervous being on the bench now?
No, I don't get. I wouldn't say I get nervous on the bench. I certainly was always nervous, including to the day I took the bench as an advocate. Every time that I argued, you know, if you're not nervous, then you don't care. It's just part of that is just adrenaline. And do nerves fade over time? Yes. The first time you walk in a courtroom, you're like petrified. You don't know where to sit, you know, all of that. That gets easier. But when you and for me, when I would do an oral argument or go into trial, I would always be pretty nervous when I started. But once I was in it, then I just kind of got in it. You know, and in an appellate argument, just answering the questions and focused on that. And that helped the nerves quite a bit. But, you know, again, I think we're not human if we're not a little bit nervous. And I think anyone who says they're not nervous at all, probably not being completely candid. It just comes with the adrenaline that happens with that. You want to do a good job. And when you're an advocate, there's risk. There's always risk you're going to lose, and you don't want to lose. So does it fade over time? Yes. It gets better the more you go. I don't find myself being nervous on the bench. And we've had some high profile cases where, you know, it certainly wasn't nervous about where I'm sitting or that. And I think probably taking out the advocacy piece takes away some of the nerves. You know, I'm in a position as a judge. My client is not is subject to losing. And so that makes that a little bit easier.
Thank you. It's helpful to hear that those nerves can fade over time. What are the most important skills an attorney should be intentional about developing early on in their career or practice?
Probably the skill that comes more with time is the strategic thinking part of it. So we come out of law school with an ability to analyze, you know, the law, to write a cogent argument or to think through or outline a cogent argument that makes analytic sense. What comes with more experience is the strategic thinking part of it. Which argument is really more persuasive here, or likely to persuade? So that's kind of a little bit harder to cultivate. But things like, you know, I've done oral arguments, for example, where I thought I had a strong piece and someone would listen to it, or a moot court, I meant to say, where someone who's listening said, that's really factual. That's not going to win. Where's the legal hook here? And so experienced advocates are always good about finding a legal hook, about finding a particular legal hook where there's play on your side, And so those are the kind of things that come with experience. I think another thing that you cultivate just comes with more experience is your ability to be flexible, to really change gears on the fly. When you're a less experienced lawyer, you're kind of ready with your outline and you're prepared to go through the outline and kind of along the lines of what you asked me before. When you get a question that comes from, you know, a different direction or moves you somewhere else on the outline, a less experienced lawyer is going to start fumbling around with their outline to try to find that page, right? And a more experienced lawyer will more seamlessly be able to move to it. Relating to that, more seamlessly, you know, getting interrupted by a question, you answer the question, and the more experience you have, the easier it is to get back to where you were or to seamlessly transition. Those are the kind of things that they really don't teach in law school, that really just take more experience. But probably the big one is the strategic thinking about whether you're in a trial or an appellate argument. Where is my best chance of success with this court, given the precedent that I'm dealing with? And being able to think strategically about that is something that I think probably we could spend more time in law school. It's not anything that you get smarter, but that's something we don't focus on so much in law school. When I used to hear judges say this when I was in practice, I hated it. And now I say it. The briefs are too long. We just lose sight of where we're going. And anymore, and I say this with kindness, a legal brief is not a law review article. A legal brief is not an issue spotting exam. And in fairness, I say the same about a judicial opinion. Judicial opinions are too long. I don't need to know the history of the world from the primordial ooze to the present. Start in a logical place. Tell me the facts that I need to know to understand your analysis. And that may mean I don't need a lot of facts. I'm not fond of reading a brief when I get 6 footnotes in the first 2 paragraphs and I'm going up and down and up and down. It's not a law review article. It's not an issue spotting exam. Get to the point. And I think we're seeing more because of, we're such so risk averse as lawyers and we're afraid of leaving something out. We overdo it and we put every fact in the record, whether it's relevant or not. And I think you end up confusing the court. My biggest pet peeve to me is when I read a long brief and I realize I didn't have to read 25 pages of it. Another pet peeve is when facts are put in there for no reason other than to bias me against the other side when they're not really relevant. You'd be amazed how transparent that is. And it comes across as a little condescending. Really? You think you got to play with my emotions here? How about not waste my time? And so those are kinds of things I think you learn more with time. But I wish we would talk more in law school in legal writing about getting us to write this way as opposed to this way.
Thank you for that point about getting to the point. I know it's a challenge I've faced, getting more concise with my words and being more intentional with my language. So thank you for emphasizing the importance of being concise and getting to the point.
It's reminiscent of Mark Twain, who famously apologized to a friend for writing a really long letter because he didn't have time to write a shorter one. It's hard to write a shorter brief. It takes more work to kill your darlings when you edit, but it makes for a better brief when you do it.
A career in the legal profession is bound to have some intense moments, times when you're preparing for a trial, times when you have an overwhelming caseload, or just times when balancing work and family life can be extremely difficult. What advice do you have? What helped you push through challenging moments in your own career? What helped keep you focused, mentally sharp, and motivated when being an attorney gets intense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we all have these kind of moments. Law can be very stressful. So the first most important thing to get through the hard times is to take care of your health. Lawyers are not good about health and well-being. Wellness matters. And so making sure you maintain, you know, good health. You're really stressed. Taking a walk in the sunshine is helpful. Eating well. One of my former law partners and mentors used to say, when you're in trial, sleep is a weapon. The other side is going to be doing all-nighters. You get a little bit of rest. There comes a time when you're preparing for an oral argument or a trial or whatever else, the law of diminishing returns comes into play. You're not, you know, you're just staying up and you're too tired to focus. Much better to go get some sleep. So that's really, really important. You know, and we're all in times where we're very stressed and we think the end of the world has happened, especially if we make a mistake in a case, and we all will. You all will make a mistake, and you go into all the doomsday scenarios. They're going to sue me for malpractice and whatever else. You got to take time to breathe, maybe find a mentor to talk it through, to think about what you're going to do, but trying to breathe, take a beat before you kind of panic, and be able to think logically about what to do. But I think there's just the simple answer is there's no substitute for your health and well-being. There's no substitute from walking away when you need to, and no substitute for find good mentors who you can go talk to through difficult problems, and you know, or a significant other or somebody else who can be sympathetic. To that, I think is really important. You know, you think when we're in the middle of it that there's just no escape. Your workload can never go away until a crisis happens to you. Both my parents have been deceased for a long time. And I lost a brother as well. When that happens, it's amazing how easy it is for you to just walk away from your office and leave everything. And you know what? It's all there when you come back. And so we sometimes, when we're in the throes of it, we forget that sometimes you can walk away. More micro kind of points, make time. I'm not proud of what I'm about to say, but I am a pathological workaholic. It's been an issue for me my whole life. It is not something I'm proud of. It is a major fault. If you're that kind of personality, schedule your downtime. You know, whether it's a date night with a significant other or something like that, if you're that kind of person and you need to schedule it, then do that. But make sure you find the time to walk away. And having said that, I'm going to confess I'm not always very good at that myself. I'm good about saying it, but I try.
Justice Gabriel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with Charleston School of Law students today. We really appreciate your advice and insight and wisdom and sharing your own perspective with us. I've certainly found it valuable, and I know everyone in this room is grateful as well. So thank you.